abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. I've got a surprise guest for you guys at the end of the week. I'll be revealing the identity of that person after my conversation with Steve Hogarth. You've got to listen to my conversation with Steve Hogarth. What an absolute thrill and a treat to talk to the lead vocalist of Marillion, an extraordinary band founded in 1979. Hogarth joined as the vocalist, taking over from a man popularly known as Fish in 1989, and he continues to lead Marillion 25 years later. Theirs is a tremendous story of fan loyalty and creativity, and of the enormous potential, even early on, of the internet. You're going to love this story, and it's my pleasure right now to welcome to the program Steve Hogarth. I cannot tell you how glad I am to be talking to you. Thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Well,
I wanted to have you on
not only because you're a great musician, but also because the story of Marillion, particularly since you joined the band, is so interesting in terms of what your fan base has accomplished. I mean, you must just be in awe of this. But before we get to that, what I did in anticipation of this program, since I have a lot of young listeners, they may not be as familiar with your work, I posted on my website, I put a special page, tomwoods.com/Hogarth, and all I put up there was the live performance from the 2007 Marillion weekend of Neverland. Because I'm telling you, you know, you've done a lot of songs that are more musically complicated than that one, but the fact is, that live performance just blows me away. Like, that middle part where the lights come up and the confetti's coming down has got to be the biggest rush in the world to be part of that. So can you just tell us, if you had to describe Marillion for somebody who's never heard them before, what's your niche? Like, what makes you different from something else we might hear on the radio?
Oh, my goodness. I suppose we're very honest, you know. You're going to get truth out of us. You're not going to get songs that we're painstakingly crafted to sell large amounts or to be on the radio. You're going to get songs that were written in order to express some kind of deep feeling. And it's so hard for me to describe our music beyond that. You know, we're a band, I guess, we don't really have any limits. So our influences are extremely broad-based. They call us a progressive rock band, but we're not really. I mean, for any label they could hang on us, I could name a song that contradicts that we've released. So I don't know how. I mean, I'm not really here to sell myself to your fans. All they can do is listen.
Well, I think that is the best thing, but I think that does describe what the niche of Marillion is. That it's not like I don't want to put other people down, but let's say there are some bands that if you have one album, you pretty much have them all. Whereas every single one of these, this is why Marillion is one of these bands whose catalog I want the entirety of, because everything's different. Now, on this point that you produce stuff not necessarily thinking in terms of, well, this will be our hit single, your fans have shown the potential of the internet long before I think a lot of other people realize the potential that it had, in two particular occasions to help you guys out. And I'm sorry, I don't know the order of them, which one came first, but I know that your fan base traditionally has been more in Europe than in the United States, and it's hard to make a U.S. tour feasible. That was the case some years ago. And then what did your fans suddenly do?
Well, that was in 1997. We have an awful lot to thank our American fans for, because it was really them who introduced us to the idea that perhaps we the way forward for us was to turn the fan base into a family, and effectively by using the internet to finance future projects. Things like this have become fairly mainstream ideas now, and they're using Kickstarter to fund movies and to fund music and other art projects. But Kickstarter really was something that we invented. They just sort of took it up and they've marketed it and made it bigger. But if you look it all up on Wikipedia, we started it. And we really have the American fans to thank for that. They saw that we weren't going to come to the USA in 1997. And some guy called Jeff opened a bank account and put up a thing on a notice board on the fledgling internet saying, we want to see Marillion come here, send me some money. And the first, I mean, I'm the lead singer in the band, and the first I knew about it, he already had $20,000 in the bank. Huh. I think they subsequently raised $60,000 or $70,000. And they just gave it to us and said, okay, come to America. And, of course, when we came, everyone who'd already pledged some money still had to go out and buy a ticket for the show.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it taught us two things. I mean, one, for the first time, we really realized that our fans were prepared to put hard cash where their mouths were, if you know what I mean. And the second thing it taught us was that whatever this internet thing is, we'd better get onto it because it's the future. And so we have the American fans to thank for everything that we've later been given the credit for. Like we had some piece of genius and some amazing light came on in our heads collectively, and we saw the future. Well, we did, but it was dropped into our lap by the Americans.
And that wasn't the last time that the internet was used for you guys in this sort of way. Then, when you went into the studio on at least, I think, one occasion, you guys are concerned. You don't want to be thinking in terms of, well, we've got to produce something that the American public that listens to Lady Gaga will purchase. We want to produce something that's good. And so you also were able to get the fans to put up to help defray expenses to do a new album.
Yeah, that was really just a natural consequence of what had happened with the tour fund in the States. While we were in America, we ran into a kid called Eric Nielsen, who was in college in Cleveland, Ohio. And he told us he had answered an advertisement to be our keyboard technician. But when we met him, he told us that he knew how to program websites. And so we said, you don't fancy living in England for a little while, do you? And we brought him back with us. And we were the first rock and roll band in the UK, to my knowledge, to have a website that was really working back in 97. And we ran with it from there. Our keyboard player, Mark Kelly, is a bright boy. And he said, well, why don't we find a way to find out who listens to us? At that point, our database was very small. I think we had a couple of thousand people on it, which was effectively our fan club. We didn't know who. We were selling hundreds of thousands of albums, but we didn't know who to. So he said, what we need to do is persuade our record label to make a package with a spare hole in it, and we'll put in the sleeve, there's another album you can have with this album, and it's free. And all you've got to do is ask us for it. And so we did that. And, of course, everybody wanted it because it was free, so everyone who bought our album wrote to us and asked us for it. And overnight, our database went from a couple of thousand to 100,000.
Excellent.
And then we had their email addresses, of course. And we had their postal addresses. And so we said, well, why don't we send an email to everybody we've got email addresses for and just say, we've had this idea. We're thinking of making a record, and we'd like you to buy it before we even record it. And if you buy it before we record it, we'll put your name on the thanks list. So the following week, we said if that's something you personally would buy into, reply to yes at marillion.com, and if it's not, reply to no. So we didn't need to read the emails, we just needed to count them. And 95% of the people who replied said, yeah, where do I send the money? And
that's
this
incredible.
Gave us the confidence then to actually run with that and put the put the pre-order of the album on sale. So again, we were the first band ever in the world, to my knowledge, we invented the concept of pre-ordering an album in order to finance it. And 13,000 people bought it for £30, and 13,000 names went in the thanks list on her album sleeve.
That's incredible. In alphabetical order? Somebody alphabetized them?
I believe so, yeah. If you open the special edition of Anarachnophobia, then you'll see 13,000 names.
That's unbelievable.
In alphabetical order. I think mine's in there somewhere.
Nice. Now, you recently did, I mean, not too long ago, you did a U.S. tour. How did it go?
Oh, it went really well. We didn't need to ask for funding.
Great.
For that one. But we did have to lean a little bit on the promoters and explain to them that they could actually charge more than double the price for Marillion that they figured they would charge. That's always been a problem we've had, is that they look at us and the promoters look at us and they go, okay, we'll set this ticket price at such and such. And the fact is that our fans are so dedicated to us that they'd happily pay twice or three times that. And if we can pitch a ticket price much higher than perhaps a lot of other bands, then we can come and play there without the tour losing money, because unlike some other bands who are funded by their record labels and perhaps their big management companies, we have to make books balance.
We've
got old, we've been around a long time, and we slowly figured the music business out. And now we're kind of better at it than the people who used to manage us and used to be our record labels.
Yeah, I'll bet. Now, you know, I read an article, I'd say probably about just a week or two ago. I think it was on, it was noting that it's about the 20th anniversary of the Brave album. And so it was kind of an overview of you and the band. And I learned something in there I hadn't realized, which is that sort of on the eve of getting this gig with Marillion, you were, of course, in the music industry. You were considering leaving for just sort of an ordinary workaday job. And then all of a sudden, you got an offer from Marillion and then another. I think the way you put it was, I had a choice between the most fashionable band at that time or the least fashionable band, and I chose the least. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's all true. You know, I was really hacked off with the music business after my previous band had split up. I'd been signed to CBS, which is now Sony, and if being signed to a big label like that doesn't put you off making music forever, nothing will. And it put me off making music forever. So I decided that we would sell the house and we would move to a little village somewhere and I'd be a milkman and never make any more music. And having made that decision and made the for sale sign for the house and everything, then the phone rang. And first it was Matt Johnson from a band called The asking me if I'd like to go out on tour and play piano for him in the summer with Johnny Marr from the Smiths on guitar and James Ella from the Pretenders on bass. And he had this amazing band. And so suddenly, from deciding to leave the music business, I was then looking at the prospect of doing something like that. And I thought, that'll be really good for me, because I won't be at the front in the middle. I won't have the spotlight on me. I can just go and enjoy playing again and, you know, do a little tour. It won't be about me. I can just do my thing. And I get all of the pleasure with none of the pressure, you know. So I'd really got my heart set on doing that. And then, of course, the phone rang again. And it was someone from the management office of Marillion saying, you know, how do you fancy being the lead singer in Marillion? I said, well, what happened to Fish? And he said, oh, he left. You know, he left 6 months ago, and they've heard some of your songs and your singing, and they'd really like to meet you. And I just thought, oh, my God, that's about the last thing on earth I want to do. But it's a long story, but they hustled me into it. They happened to know one of my mutual friends, a guy called Daryl Way, who was the original violinist in a band called Curved Air, which was the band that Stuart Copeland from The Police first drummed in. Daryl was my drinking mate in Windsor, and Ian Mosley had worked with Daryl. And so they whispered in Daryl's ear, and Daryl whispered in my ear and said, don't just dismiss this out of hand, you know, because they're really, you know, they're really nice guys, and they do really interesting things, and you should at least go and meet them. And so Daryl persuaded me to go and meet them, and the rest is hysterical, as they say.
Now, what has your relationship been with Fish? Is this an awkward question?
It's not awkward. A lot of people ask me, but it's a similar relationship to, you know, if some guy's married and his marriage goes wrong and he gets divorced and he meets another woman and marries her, and then a lot of people come along asking her what her relationship's like with the guy's ex-wife, she's probably going to go, well, I haven't really got one, you know. I don't know her, I never see her, you know, why would I? So it's a little bit like that, but having said that, I have met him a few times. We've always got on very well. You know, the first time we met was a little bit awkward on my part, I suppose. I felt a bit reticent about meeting him, but he couldn't have been nicer. So we don't see each other very often because we have no reason to, but when we do, we get on fine. He's a nice guy. He's a talented guy. And I respect him.
What do you think your best work is with Marillion? Like, what are you proudest of in the whole catalog?
Probably The Invisible Man, the first song on the Marbles album, that's the essence of what we are, all in phase and all working in train at once, I think. The Marbles album overall was a pretty good one. The most recent one, Sounds That Can't Be Made, I'm very proud of. But there's probably a song on every album we've made together now, and we've made, 12 or 13 since I joined the band. And there's probably one song on each album that, you know, I would really feel is outstanding.
It's funny you say The Invisible Man, because when I put Neverland up also on my Facebook page to tell people I was going to be talking to you, and I said, this is my favorite live performance of anything ever, I was corrected by someone and said, no, the performance of The Invisible Man beats this. So it's so he was correct indeed. So what's coming up for you and or Marillion in the future? Is there anything you haven't told anybody before that you can spill the beans about for the first time here?
Oh God! Is there anything I haven't told about? Well, I have a diary coming out, which will tell an awful lot about life on the road and how my life has been. Since 1992, I've been keeping a diary. You know, day to day. Sometimes it'll be about touring or recording. Sometimes it will be about being at home, fixing the washing machine or cleaning behind the oven, taking the kids to the park. And it's coming out in two volumes, I think, because once we got down to it, we realized it was too much for one book. So it's going to come out in two books. And the diary is called The Invisible Man. And it should be available in May this year. And you can find out all about what goes on behind the scenes in that, and what my life is like and what touring life is really like. In the future, as from now, Marillion are about to embark upon a cruise with a band called Yes.
Oh, I love Yes.
Well, they have a... they have a thing that they're going to do early in April called Cruise to the Edge, and it's a cruise liner which sets sail out of Miami and goes down to Cozumel in Mexico, takes about a week, and it's a sort of a rock festival on a boat, you know, and there's lots of different artists doing it. The Straubs are doing it. Steve Hackett is playing. Yes, of course, are doing it. And I think we're technically second on the bill. And we'll be doing that. And then in May, we're touring in South America and Mexico. And then for the rest of the year, we'll be in the studio staring at each other like giant pandas trying to mate. which is roughly the process that brings about the next album.
Well, the last thing I'll leave you with is, you know, I've got a reasonably high-ranked podcast on iTunes, and I'm happy with that, but I'm not the most listened-to person in the world. I mean, I can put out a book, and it'll sell pretty well, and that's fine, and I know I'm never going to be the number one, just by the nature of the things, because of, you know, I'm not the most mainstream guy and all that. And I accept that. I'm completely at peace with that. I'm happy that I have people who support me and they're very loyal, and that's great. And I think of that as being sort of like where you guys are musically with Marillion. That unfortunately, the general public listens to Lady Gaga, but there's a good, solid niche that loves what you guys do. But is there any moment in your life when you say, you know, it's darn frustrating that a lot of people want to listen to Pap, and whereas I go out every night performing with my heart on my sleeve with some really great and interesting music, and yet the public wants to listen to totally forgettable stuff. Does that ever consume you, or do you not think about that?
I think it did a little bit at one stage, but I don't think that's very wise, to be honest. I think wisdom is to celebrate, especially if you're in the position that we're in, where we're creatively free and we're still getting away with making a living out of doing what we do, and we can do it in just any way we choose. And when we come to write our next song, there won't be anybody from a record label breathing down our neck saying it has to sound like this or it has to go like that. I think, you know, the likes of Lady Gaga and the Madonnas and the whoever's at number one in the chart, there's a terrible price to pay for that kind of popularity, because you can be tied up 100 ways. And, you know, I'd rather be free and pure and be doing my thing than be number one in the charts and tied down by all the sort of bullshit that ties those artists down. I don't envy them that.
Well, very well said. Well, Steve Hogarth, I can't tell you what a privilege and a pleasure it's been. I was afraid that when I got you on, I would be like the most pathetic fanboy ever. But I think I've maintained my dignity throughout our chit-chat, and I certainly appreciate your time. Best of luck with everything. With the cruise sounds fantastic, with the upcoming diary, the tour, and we can't wait to hear what comes out of that studio session. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the interview.
All right, everybody, that was Steve Hogarth. I'm going to reveal to you guys now who the mystery guest will be. On Friday, we're going to be talking to Carol Paul, the matriarch of the Paul family. And I need to know what you guys want me to ask her. I'm going to ask her your questions. I've got a thread on this opened up at my Facebook page. So make sure and like that page. Don't look for me as Tom Woods. My Facebook page is facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods. Just look for the Carol Paul thread, the What Should I Ask Her thread, and please, please contribute a question. Let's make this interesting and fun. Also, I want to remind you guys how much I appreciate those of you who are spreading the word about this program. I really appreciate it. If you could link to the page of the show, TomWoodsRadio.com, on your Facebook page or on Twitter or on your blog, I would really, really appreciate that. All I have is word of mouth. That's all I've got. And I think we're putting out a pretty good program here on a regular basis. And the more people who know about it, the better. I'm doing this because I feel like I'm so busy with that Ron Paul homeschool program that I just can't do anything else. I don't have time to write the way I used to. So this is something that sort of makes me feel useful every day. And the more you guys are able to help me get the word out about it, the better. I sure appreciate it. Of course, you're helping me pay my bills, which I also appreciate. When you enter Amazon through the widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. Now, before I let you go, I want to read to you the words to The Invisible Man, which Hogarth just told us is basically his proudest achievement. So I just want to read the words to you. Now, I know a lot of people, they read rock music words. They think, oh, it's so deep, and it's really not. But I don't know. I just like the words to The Invisible Man. So we're going to close the program with The Invisible Man. It goes as follows. The world's gone mad, and I have lost touch. I shouldn't admit it, but I have. It slipped away while I was distracted. I haven't changed. I swear I haven't changed. How did this happen? I didn't feel myself evaporating. My body has gone, but my eyes remain, hovering, witnessing, cold as a ghost, watching the streets sheltering in doorways of Venice, Vienna, Budapest, Krakow, and Amsterdam. I have become the invisible man. The invisible heart beating against you, the invisible pulse silently thumping. I shout my name in the public places. No one seems to notice. No one understands. I stand perfectly still in the middle of the road. I hold my nerve. I hold my nerve. Hold my nerve. But the cars don't swerve. I will hear your prayers as you whisper alone. I am the one you felt was close, close behind you in St. Stephen. You lit a candle. Blessings in the cold night air. I'll feel your breath as you turn to go. I'll watch you leave from somewhere up high as you cross the park in the autumn light. If I close my eyes, I can see where you live, climb the winding stairs up to your apartment. The scent of you preparing his evening meal, I must watch in dread when he's cruel to you in horrified silence. As you make love, I cannot lift a hand to stop him. I don't exist. What can I do? What can I do? I will scream in your ear as you're passing by. I will wrap my arms around you. You won't hear, you won't feel me. I will walk stride for stride with you. I will try to help. When you will stumble through me. I have become the invisible man. It's all I am, invisible. I have read all your letters. I know what you contain. I have dreamt your dreams. My head is haunted. I will scream again. I am perfectly sane. I am perfectly sane. But I am the invisible man. I am the invisible man. Talk to me. Acknowledge me. Confide in me. Confess to me. Or leave me be. Leave me be. Check them out. SteveHogarth.com and, of course, Marillion.com. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.